everyone. This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful, as always, for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we're talking with Professor Manuela Achilles, director of the Center for German Studies at the University of Virginia. Her expertise is the Weimar Republic, Nazi, and modern Germany. Her current book, In Progress, is Invisible Fatherland, Constitutional Patriotism, and the Desire for Democracy in Weimar Germany. We'll discuss how this part of the history of Germany gave way to Nazi Germany and what they can do, what they've been doing now to prevent fascism, and much more. Also on the program is Jason Belford, Chief Information Security Officer at the University of Virginia. We'll discuss what cybersecurity really is. We'll look into the Equifax breach, ransomware, the latest Wi-Fi hack to cell phones, and what we can do to protect our privacy. Check out all our past shows, including this one, very soon on the station website, 947wpvc.org. But first, I must ask, Nancy, are you there?
You must. I am here, Ellen. How are you doing over there?
Oh, you know.
In the Charlottesville
office.
We never find out what is going on in the Charlottesville office. It's always about Nancy in the New York office.
No, I mention us, and there's quite a lot going on here right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you can't see it, but we're all yeah, we'll keep you in a little bit of mystery.
Yeah, I need Mr. Belford to install some sort of, I need some ransomware. I need something to know what's going on over there. I need to be infiltrating everything. I'm pretty sure there's a coup going on and you want me out. I'm worried now.
I mean, I think the show's the most apropos so far when you talk about a coup, the rise of Nazi Germany and losing our identity.
Yeah, isn't it amazing how we wind up? It is totally usually accidental that the pairings we have on the show somehow there you can connect dots to them. It's odd.
It is. So I wanted to ask you about something.
Okay.
Are you ready for this? As the wheels spin,
I will scramble to get that answer.
It's such good radio as the wheels turn in my head. I just wanted to bring up the Duty to Warn group again. That is an association. This is real. Mental health professionals and other concerned citizens.
Yeah.
And they're advocating for Trump's removal under the 25th Amendment that he, on the grounds that he's psychologically unfit. And they have a website, adutytowarn.org. So speaking of warning, what did you think? Obama and G.W. Bush spoke this week on division and fear. Do you think that kind of thing helps?
Actually, well, the short answer is yes, I do. And sadly, though I'm a realist, I am pleased that George Bush, spoke out because he's a white man and a Republican. And I know that seems to matter on the news, you know. So I'm grateful to both of them. I know I have not forgotten how he terribly handled the war, got us into that war. But I will totally take that he has a sense of unity for the country and is calling out this nationalism as nativism. I loved all of that, and I will take it because in this country, being a white man and a Republican seems to really matter right now. So I was grateful, is my answer to you. And, of course, Obama. I mean, of course, I don't mean to put him second. It's just you don't hear from Bush. So it was a novelty that I appreciated, actually.
Right. And being a Republican. And I think there are people that are still, you know, they're the Republicans that he speaks to.
Right.
And so I think that is really good.
I totally agree.
Yeah. And I would just, don't you just want, it's so odd how we wish for him back, you know, in a way. Well, maybe not the whole Cheney gang, but.
On the record, I don't wish him back, but I do, you know, I will take the guy that now paints pictures and says, and says the nation should remember its constitution. You know, I wish, and of course, I wish he would have said more. Anyway, it just shows to me and to many other people just how desperate we really are for leadership. You know, that we just that's what was so wonderful. You know, just hearing both of them speak about things that unite us, or just for stop dividing us. You know, just the guy Trump is a master at just finding division and mm-hmm. separating
and
us
and exploiting
so
it.
Even though it was only, I don't know, 40 minutes tops, the two of them, you know, just hearing any excerpts, just like, oh, that's right. We used to, our leaders used to talk like this, you know?
Yes.
This is kind of who we are, but God, we just don't, we can't get a breath, you know, because of this White House.
Right. So pointing to some events, something we can do about this mess. This Sunday, that's tomorrow, October 22nd, 2:45, Door Knocking with Tom Perriello and Ralph Northam themselves with Indivisible Group, celebrating afterwards a beer run, and they're going to meet at 156 Carlton Road. And Saturday, the 28th, from 2 to 5, is an event called Decolonizing Gender Relations, Unlearning Everyday Patriarchy with Shay Akil McLean at the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center. And I must mention the Persimmon Festival for a little bit of lightness on 10/28 as well, Saturday, next Saturday at Edible Landscaping. It is really a treat.
Oh, I don't doubt it. The other two Sundays are very good as well, but of course, anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no, because I almost forgot that what we mention every time is upcoming Virginia general election, November 7th, the biggest election since Trump took office. Don't forget.
Yeah, are you feeling it? You must be feeling it down there, just that the election is coming up.
Mm-hmm. And some really horrible ads we won't go All into. Right. But also next week, I want to mention on our show, Richard Bonney, UVA professor of law and medicine, will be here to talk about the opioid epidemic. And Ryan Wright will give us a look into the dark web and something called the deep web.
Mm. Yeah, I'm sure there's a connection between the opioid epidemic and that, which we will discover before the end of next week's show. I don't doubt it.
Yes. Good point. So we have a great, great show today. Our first guest is Manuela Achilles. She is the professor and director of the Center for German Studies at the University of Virginia. Her expertise is the Weimar Republic, Nazi Germany, modern Germany, the history and theory of democracy, democracy and violence, and that's only the tip of the iceberg, believe it or not. Her current book is in progress. It's Invisible Fatherland, Constitutional Patriotism, and the Desire for Democracy in Weimar Germany. Welcome, Professor Achilles.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Great. So getting right into it, how did the Weimar Republic, which preceded Nazi Germany, give way to that regime?
Well, Alan, this is a complicated and probably long story. And I would kind of explaining it in three stages. The Weimar Republic was founded after the war. So there's the First World War, there's a foundational period, and that was marked by turbulence, by revolution, by constitution writing, civil war. It was really a very complicated situation from 1918 to 1923. Then there's a period of relative stability, where the culture flourishes, where the economy stabilizes, where democracy stabilizes to some extent, and actually also with our help, we are extending loans to the Weimar government. They are kind of paying their reparations, they're rebuilding with it. And then in 1929, the recession hits. And we have something to do with that too. The Wall Street crash and what follows hits everybody, especially Germany's loans are not being extended. Unemployment rises dramatically. Government coalitions can't be forged anymore because there's so much polarization in the political system. And that is when the Nazis rise, when they have their first successes in 1930, and when then up to 1932, they are increasing their share of the votes to about 40%. We should kind of keep in mind, though, that the Nazis never have an absolute majority in that system. They needed help from somebody else. They needed help from the conservatives, from the alt-right that helped them to convince the president to nominate Hitler or to sign on to Hitler's Hitler becoming the chancellor of the Weimar Republic.
We're speaking with Manuel Achilles at 947 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is apropos of something.
Hey, Manuela, when they appointed Hitler as chancellor, I know they voluntarily did that because of this coalition government, as you said, but they thought they could control him, is that right?
Yes, the idea was basically, so you have to know, just think about it. The Nazi movement has about 40% of the votes. The conservatives have about 7 to 8% of the votes. So together they can build a coalition. And the idea of the old right, or of the conservatives is to tame the Nazis, to use that mass base to, kind of establish a more authoritarian republic and to lead that coalition. So yes, they do think they can control the Nazis, but it is, of course, as we know from history, not the case that that is possible. The more extreme and radical partner in this coalition wins out very quickly.
Was the level of violence that, you know, his signature kind of violence, did that happen right away when he became chancellor, or did it escalate?
So it depends how you define or what you're looking at when you're talking about violence. There is a lot of violence in the last phase of the Weimar Republic. So between 1930 and 1933, when the economic crisis escalates and unemployment is high, you have lots of street battles, for example, between communists and the SA, the Nazi paramilitary organization. And that violence is purposeful for the Nazis. They want to break the back of the government. So that is kind of street violence, right? And then after 1933, yes, you have the Nazis together with the conservatives being in control of the state, and that is a different kind of violence that we are talking about then, where the Nazis increasingly use the police and the state apparatus to suppress oppositional movements.
Yeah. Are there parallels between the Weimar Republic and where we are today? Do you see similarities?
Well, this is a complicated question. When I talk with my students about the Weimar Republic, we are talking a lot about how actually, and you see it in Weimar, how vulnerable democracy is and how easy it is to plant suspicions against it and to attack it, and how important it is to insist there are certain values in a democracy we should share in common, and that is rejection of violence, and that is a trust in the rule of law, as enshrined in the Constitution, and also, of course, certain ideas about inclusion. And so when you look at Weimar, and of course another thing is an affirmation of a free press and a free media. When you're looking at Weimar, maybe you see certain tendencies certain urgency to protect the base values, the basic values of democracy, and I think that's what we need to do.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this is an inevitable thing, that the turn of events that have been happening here in terms of what you've seen in history and how vulnerable democracy really is? And what can we do, given the lessons of history, about it? So I guess what I mean is, so now, are you surprised at what's happening? I mean, you've seen it before, obviously, and you've studied it very closely. Is this something that surprises you in this country, or is democracy just, you know, this very, very vulnerable institution, as you've said, or form of government?
Let me tell you a little story. This summer I was in Berlin. And I was in Berlin on August 11 and 12th. When I was in Berlin, I was kind of talking with people and friends. Nobody ever knew where Charlottesville is. I had to explain this. It was a big city. This be in Berlin. Berlin has everything, right? Also, people from places, and nobody knows where those places are, right? That is Berlin. That's part of a small minority coming from a place nobody knew about. After August 11 and 12, everything changed. Why? Because the images of what happened here in Charlottesville were in the media, were everywhere, and Germans immediately, from the images they saw, translated these images to the 1930s, images that they had seen. And suddenly, Charlottesville was a name, and it became an interest of all of my friends who asked me, what's going on there? For Germans, this really resonated immediately, right? And they were wondering. It's not that Germany doesn't have their share of neo-Nazis and proto-fascists, but they are not connected to small-town colleges in the United States. So this is something to think about. What does it mean? These images certainly went around the world, and there are questions about it now, how, to what extent it relates to the 1930s. I find it very legitimate, but answers are complicated to this. It's not the same. So, but certainly it is a threat to our democracy when people with torches shouting disrespectful and violent slogans that recall the Nazi period invade our cities and grounds.
This is 94.7 WPVC. You're listening to Apropos of Something. We're speaking with Manuela Achilles. She is the director of the Center for German Studies at the University of Virginia. So I have a question. So the all the torches and all of that stuff. When we talk about things here among my friends, we always refer to, we talk about the Confederate flag as being a symbol, a very bad symbol in our opinion. And we say in Germany the swastika is outlawed. Is that so? What has Germany done? What are the lessons that they've learned the hard way, and what can we learn from that?
This is a very interesting and important question. At the level of history, it is important to know that Germany, after 1945, has gone through a process that in Germany is called Vergangenheitsbewältigung, working through the past. And it was a complicated process. It didn't start in 1945 with everybody admitting that Nazi Germany had been bad and confessing to their crimes. That took a generation, and it was more in the 60s with a new generation that difficult questions were asked and crimes were confronted. And it is an ongoing process. If you go to cities like Berlin, for example, you see that past reflected in the architecture, in monuments, in the museums, also in the school curricula everywhere in Germany. There is a discussion about this. So that is that is one thing, working through the past, confronting it.
Okay, I want to just go to a heartbreak. I'm sorry. I'm giving her confusing hand signals. She's so attentive, which is so great. What a great guest. Manuela Achilles, director of the Center for German Studies. We'll be right back after this break. We'll also be talking with very soon Jason Belford, Chief Information Security Officer at the University of Virginia. We're going to be talking about the Equifax breach and so much more. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're going to continue talking with Manuela Achilles, director of the Center for German Studies at UVA. In just a few more moments, we're going to talk to Jason Belford as well, chief information security officer at UVA. We're going to discuss lots of things, hacking, phishing, the Equifax breach. But back to, I rudely interrupted Manuela. And we were talking about, she was answering a complicated question, it sounded like, maybe not so, but a three-part answer about what Germany has learned and what's gone on there, and, you know, how they've dealt with that history.
Yeah, I think I wanted also to talk about something that's probably a little bit alien to us, namely putting restrictions on free speech, for example, and not allowing you to publicly carry Nazi symbols or to extend the Hitler salute or the like. This is something you cannot do under the law in Germany. And then they enshrined also certain protections in their constitution that cannot be lifted and that allow actually the German Constitutional Court to dissolve parties that are not operating in line with the principles enshrined in the constitution. In plain text, that means you can dissolve parties, neo-Nazi parties or extremist left-wing parties, and Germany happened twice.
You can dissolve
okay. them. There are legal procedures for this, and whenever neo-Nazi parties start to flourish or to emerge and to flourish, there is a big discussion about whether that should happen or not. There is also a clause in the Constitution defining the political system that requires every party to have at least 5% of the vote to be represented as a party in the parliament. That is supposed to prevent the fractioning of the political spectrum. So that is something they learned from Weimar. If there are too many different parties and many of them are extremists, you can't build coalitions. So they want to make sure that every party has a specific size, that every party is in line with the values defined in the constitution, and that to build then coalition governments on that basis. So there are protections enshrined in the constitution that want to help maintain it, and that is a lesson learned from Weimar, which was unprotected. It was very open, it was very liberal, and it was unprotected against the onslaught from the radical right, and that's a lesson learned mm-hmm. in Germany.
You know, I wish that, you know, I know that we don't have nearly those stipulations in the Constitution, but I have learned how vulnerable our Constitution is based on how much Trump continues to push on norms that are supposed to be adhered to. I would, I wonder is what. Are we set up in it? Because I don't even know this. Are we set up in a different way? He's being enabled because the Republican Congress is just letting him slip and slide through these loopholes in the Constitution. Is the German, the way they've rewritten everything, is that, are they now wired so that what we're experiencing cannot happen there?
Well, the political system in Germany today is different. It's a different kind of democracy.
Yeah.
We have a presidential democracy in Germany, the chancellor leading the government, that is right now Angela Merkel, determines political direction of the government. So there are many, many differences between a presidential system and the system that we have, a parliamentary system that we have in Germany. So it's hard to compare it. We have the checks and balances that we have here in the United States are different, and it's important to make sure they work. And I'm not really the specialist on that part of the question. I think there are others, and we could have productive discussion about, you know, comparative discussion, what in our own system protects actually our democracy. But I do think we have to make sure that they work. And I think there's still a lot there that we can use to make it work.
So in Charlottesville, there are groups on the left and the right that are
right.
a little bit, some may say they're a little bit extreme. What do you think about the very far left and mm-hmm. what's going on here to confront Nazis, people on the mall, that kind of behavior? I'm sure it sounds like, looks like you're nodding and you're aware of that. You know, yelling in their faces or, you know, yelling at them when they're in a public place. What are your thoughts about that?
So there has been a lot of discussion, and I want to be specific to the terms and to the historical periods. There has been a lot of discussion what anti-fascism or Antifa is. If you look at this historically, we were here in the United States all anti-fascists, and we were proudly so anti-fascist when we defeated Nazi Germany. So that is a legacy of anti-fascism, too, to actually be alert and defend our democracy and to defend it also in other places and help build democracies. Germany is, of course, stable democracy also because we helped after 45 to rebuild West Germany and then helped with the unification process through Cold War and whatever. That's a complicated process, too. So I'm just saying there is a history of anti-fascism that is a history to be proud of. For me, when you are kind of thinking of groups opposing proto-fascism or neo-fascism, I think where it stops is where the violence occurs. I think it's a freedom of speech and expression on all sides, but when violence emerges, it stops. Mm-hmm. Or when violence is incited, and that applies to everybody.
You know, the thing in the riot in Charlottesville was just another example that this notion of racial and cultural superiority, not just a German thing, it's what is it about homogenizing, you know, this idea of religion and race and class, what is it about that is so appealing to people, apparently?
This is also a complicated question. I would want to bring a social psychologist into this, an anthropologist into this discussion. Let's answer it again from the perspective of Germany, with its complicated history and having learned a lot from it. As we have also read here a lot and have also seen and are also discussing, when the refugee crisis in Europe exploded, right, Germany was that country which allowed more than a million refugees from mostly Muslim countries into their country, and actually talked in Germany. They talked a lot about what they called a culture of welcome, of welcoming those people, helping and making them feel wanted. Not excluded, included actually. So that comes out of specific tradition of having learned from what happens to people when they don't find refuge elsewhere, which happened to Jews in Europe under the Nazi regime, that actually there were very few countries, including us, who were prepared to take large numbers of refugees, right? So that Germany turned around and was saying, well, wir schaffen das, we can do it. And there was kind of some agreement that this was a necessary step in the majority of the people, but look, this has also led to backlash on the right, just recently manifest in the election, and of a radical right-wing party, the Alternative for Germany, Alternative from Germany, actually gaining lots of votes and representation in the national parliament. So there is a specific group in Germany also who refuses to be integrative and multicultural and tolerant and wants to share, right? I mean, you know, what drives people to that point that they elect right-wing, xenophobic parliamentarians is something we need to better understand, but we see it happens everywhere in Europe here, across industrialized countries.
So is there a lesson that, what would you want to leave people with? Because this is not just a discussion anymore. You know, your field has really turned into a matter of life and death, or possibly for a lot of people. What would you want? What do you think we should take away
from this? So we recently at the University of Michigan in the history department, five history colleagues, including me, we did a teach-in on the fascist threat. We covered many different aspects of it. I spoke about Germany. We spoke about also what Germans learned from the Nazis actually learned from the United States, from anti-Semitism, old and new. Many topics were covered. And then in the discussion section, a student asked, so what do we do What do we take away from this? I can just tell you my own answer was, you know, we have to understand, we have to react to the challenge. But also what is very important, and that is what I learned from Weimar, is to make sure that we don't just react, but that we are conscious of our own values. And that we are conscious of kind of being able to articulate what is it about democracy, what is it about tolerance, what is it about hospitality that is valuable for all of us and connects us. And so that's was difficult for Weimar under the particular circumstances of kind of constant pressure due to economic challenges and all this kind of stuff, right? It was difficult for Weimar actually to say what was positive about it, what was positive about democracy. It was a young democracy, it was just being built. We are an established democracy. We look back at a lot of history, and we got to kind of make sure that we can articulate its value.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Manuela Achilles, yeah. Professor at the University of Virginia. Her current book in progress is Invisible Fatherland, Constitutional Patriotism and the Desire for Democracy in Weimar, Germany. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Goodness. What year is it right now?
Right.
Anyway, so I know it's time for a news of note, and mine, Ellen, is about Chief of Staff General Kelly and his contribution to the Niger ambush in his own unique way for the last week. First, you know, the usual. I won't waste time on the covering up for Trump's obvious what he said versus what he claims he didn't say. When it got ugliest for me was when Kelly did not apologize to Maisha Johnson or the family of Sergeant Johnson, when, regardless of Trump's intent, they obviously were upset by it, and he chose not to even address that. He made no public statements about that. And then he not only defended Trump, but he chose to attack Congresswoman Federica Wilson for publicizing what happened on that phone call, which I thought, as I said, was exceptionally ugly. She was in that car, by the way, because she is a family friend of theirs. She has known this Sergeant Johnson most of his life. She's a mentor to him. She wasn't just in the car, you know. I mean, he couldn't even get his facts right, Kelly. And then the last part of this ugliness was yesterday, or I believe the day before, when he intentionally brings up this made-up story of her in 2015, patting herself on the back for funding, which she did not even do because she wasn't a congresswoman at the time, chumming up to Obama, which she did not do. It was clearly not on the tape. And then apparently was greeted with applause. It was all, he conjured up this whole fake story to call her an empty barrel of all things. It was just mind-boggling that he went out of his way to disrespect Maisha Johnson, but also Congresswoman Federica Wilson. And then Sarah Sanders, of course, no surprise, stands by the general story, refuses to acknowledge it was wrong. The video proved it. And then goes the last step, brings it all home by saying that no one should question a general, you know, they are now above the law. Talk about fascism, again, tying into Manuela's topic. Then Sarah Sanders, you know, put the last part of it in by just saying that generals are above the law. And then, you know, anyway, I think Kelly should apologize to both women. And, I think he should resign. None of that will happen.
Yeah. Now I'm even more pissed than I was before listening to that. I mean, talk about what Manuela said, that we need democracy, tolerance, and hospitality. Again, once again, this regime is completely opposed. And I guess it shows that I had a little bit of hope for this guy, that he was there trying
right.
to, you know, keep his hands off the button, you know, the nuclear button. But yeah, it was really horrible.
Yeah, he's totally an enabler of Trump, like the rest of them.
I mean, just come out and, yeah, like don't take it out, don't have, you know, expose your misogyny.
Right. Twice. Right.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, I was just going to say that against, I think it was the State Department's advice, BLOTUS put Chad on the Muslim ban list, and they were actually helping us in Nigeria. And, you know, so what happens is American lives were lost. I mean, is that the Benghazi of this administration or what?
Right.
Only it's real, in my opinion.
Yes. No, it's
anyhow.
Okay.
So we're getting so agitated. So. Let's lighten things up a little bit with some cybersecurity.
Let's welcome a guest with our agitation. Go ahead.
So, no further ado, I wanted to welcome our next guest, Jason Belford, Chief Information Security Officer at the University of Virginia. He's in charge of increasing cybersecurity and lowering the risk for the entire university, as I understand it. Welcome, Jason.
Good morning.
Good morning.
No.
So, I just wondering... You have such a big job, it seems. Is the university targeted like countries are targeted? Was there anything large scale that ever happened cyber-wise?
So I think the answer is yes. Unlike countries being targeted, I mean, they're usually after military secrets, industrial espionage. At the university, we have a lot of data. We have a lot of things that different people want. We have been targeted by countries. In 2015, there were Chinese hackers that broke into the university. By the time after the investigation, we realized they got two email accounts of some Chinese descendants. Other than that, they didn't get any other data, which is very surprising. But that started a series of increasing security at the university.
Mm-hmm. Are the hidden dangers, let me just ask, are they always changing, or do you have, like, go-to things that you are mindful of?
I think it's both. Obviously, technology changes every 6 months. Well, technology security is also going to change just as rapidly. I think there's some fundamentals we can work with that are general protections, and then we always have to review that and say, what's different now? I'll go ahead and open this one up. I know we're going to talk about Equifax, but what's happening with Equifax is going to be a major game changer now that we know all of the information that we've held as secrets is out there. Who's going to use it? When are they going to use it? And how are they going to use it? But that's going to make a big difference going forward in security.
Do you have different ways to approach securing student information versus faculty versus administrative?
We have to review all the data that we have, and we look at what's the risk. If we lose this data, what's the risk of it? It could be from, is it going to provide identity fraud, the bad guy's identity fraud capabilities, or is this stuff we were making public anyway? If I stick something out on one of my web pages on purpose, I'm not going to put a lot of security around that. I don't need to spend the money or resources. However, if it's someone's social security number and birthday and all those other things, we're going to put a lot more protections in place.
You know, I got so fascinated in what we were talking about that I almost missed our heartbreak, which we're going to go to right now. We'll be right back with Jason Belford. Please stay. Nancy, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just kidding. I'm just trying to cover for myself while I turn dials and
no,
do things.
No, I'm not here.
Okay,
no.
We'll be right back.
Okay.
You're listening to Apropos of Something. I'm Ellen Daniels. I'm talking with my co-host, Nancy Lawrence, in New York City. I'm in Charlottesville, and we have a guest here, sitting here, Jason Belford, Chief Information Security Officer at UVA. We also spoke about Germany and the rise of Hitler, the Weimar Republic, with Manuela Achilles. You can listen to this. If you're listening and you know other people want to hear this, you can, or you want to catch stuff, go to the website, WPVC.org, 947WPVC.org. So, Jason, before the break, I cut you off. We were talking about Equifax and what might be different now.
So one of the things I think is going to be really different is we've always asked, or anybody, whether it's your bank or even UVA, we've asked questions that only you should know the answer to, should. Maybe it's things like social security number or last four numbers or mother's maiden name or some of those things that when you call in, people need to be able to say, yes, you are you. And those things are gone now. Now that Equifax has been broken into and that data is gone, bad guys have that data. And so now they can use it to pretend they're you. And this is going to lead to, it's got to lead to changes in how we authenticate people, how we prove they are who they are. So I think that's one of the biggest changes that's going to come up from this, other than all of your data is exposed and none of it's secret anymore.
You know, I have always wondered about that, our Social Security numbers being, for this long even, such an identifier. It's like, to me, it's like always using the same password, which everyone is, you know, is well aware you're supposed to change it X number of days constantly, and yet our Social Security number has been used to identify ourselves for way too long. I feel like, you know, this was going to happen. Not the Equifax part, but the need to stop using our Social Security numbers.
I would like to see that, too. I think the Social Security numbers were created for exactly that purpose, a Social Security number, and now we use it as an identifier, and everybody's using it. I remember the very first Social Security card I ever got on the back said, this is not an identification number. Hmm. Yet, I don't think that even appears anymore.
And so what other, how do you see any other ways that we can protect ourselves online without, you know, always being a step ahead?
I don't think we're ever going to be a step ahead, not anytime soon. But we're going to have to be able to do what we can to raise the bar. If I do certain things online, if say I'm using two-factor authentication, that's where you use not only a password, but something else like a cell phone to prove who you are. A lot of banks have implemented this. And if you use that, at least that raises the bar. For someone who else is not doing those things, they become a target or a much richer target. Online, you really need to make sure you're doing business with reputable places. If you use Google and you were looking for a certain item and you find it and you've never heard of the site that's selling it, research that. Don't just try to buy it. There's a lot of fake sites out there. Their intention is to take your money. And they look really nice. They look like they have storefronts. But they're there just to steal money, and they're long gone before you're going to get your money back. Not using a debit card online. Debit cards, the money comes right out of your bank account, and then you're going to fight to get your money back. Using a credit card online, at least you have the power of that financial institution helping you. So there's a couple things you can do just as preventative measures to help.
What's the latest Wi-Fi hack that we've been hearing about?
So it's within the way that certain pieces of the Wi-Fi, one of the Wi-Fi protocols, it's called WPA2, was generated. Some of the code they used is vulnerable. It basically means someone has to be physically with you or near you because they're going to go off the same piece of network equipment or the access point. And they can basically take over your session that you have. They won't be able to necessarily read what you're transmitting. Let's say you're sending an email. They're not necessarily going to be able to see that, but they could get some data, or they could interject data as you. This is going to probably be big. And if someone was near your house and you're online in your house or at the local coffee shop or something along those lines, a lot of the vendors have already started coming out with fixes for their equipment. There's a known fix, but folks have to apply it. Even at home, you need to update anything that you may have that's online, whether it's a TV that's communicating wirelessly or your phone, any of those things. Vendors will be coming up with updates, and you need to apply those.
Is it for every kind of device that you have, iPhone, Android, TV?
Anything that would communicate wirelessly probably is affected.
Okay.
Well, that's barely nothing these days.
I'm safe.
Okay. It seems like we have to be... it seems like we definitely have to be almost an IT person in our own lives. We can't assume that updates and protections are being installed as we sleep, right? We have to be much more vigilant. Is that the stupidest question? But please answer it.
It is absolutely not a stupid question. And this is a feeling I have every day, is that we've turned the normal consumer into having to be these IT experts of applying things. Now, there are some devices. I know some of the devices I have at home, whether it's the TV, they will automatically update, which is great. Someone's not having to do that. But there is so much that does not update at all. And so it's a fear I have, because if you don't know to do it, or if you don't have the expertise to do it, are you going to do it?
Mm-hmm. And in terms of another aspect of this, that our data is all out there, what are the implications for us now that Congress, which was a while ago already, but they're allowing telecommunication companies to sell our web browsing history without our consent, of course.
So typically they're probably not going to sell it as far as this spreadsheet that you have, that you've transmitted, they're going to go into more of a marketing mentality. So most people look at, for example, a company like Google. Google, they look at it as a browser company or an email company, and then they're not. They're a marketing company, and they're selling all that data. Or Facebook, the same thing. When I sign up for those services, I have that in mind. I know that that's what they're going to do, and I still elect to do it, but it's my choice. At that point in time, I'm not the consumer for them. I'm actually the product that they're selling. I feel much differently about it when there's a internet service provider and that I'm paying per month and they can still sell my data. So I feel a lot differently about it. But I think all of this data combined, it's a huge invasion of privacy. Privacy is defined differently by everybody. But for me, if I can take all that data and start doing identity fraud with it or embarrassment with it, I have a big problem with that.
What kind of protections do you give to students, or maybe that's the wrong word, education, do you give to your to students at UVA and teachers and administrators to help you actually keep the university safe?
So we take a defense in depth approach. That way there's not putting all our eggs in one basket. If there's a single failure, we don't have a major incident. There's things that we're doing from a network side to hopefully prevent the bad guys from coming in, from an email side. And then we do a lot of education awareness from the user side. So two examples of that are we actually send out fake phishing messages. So a phishing message is just it's a scam email. We'll send out fake phishing messages to our entire community. If they click on it and they put their password in, they get taken to a training site that says, hey, this was bad. They don't get in trouble for it. It's non-punitive. But we want to be able to reach everybody and say, this is bad stuff. And this is how a lot of these hacks you hear in the news happen, is through phishing. And then on top of that, we've implemented multi-factor authentication or two-step login. So our folks are now going to start using their usernames, passwords, and then they'll use their cell phones to say, yep, this is me.
Mm-hmm. What's the best kind of password to use?
Long.
That's a great question, Ellen, actually.
It's a great question. You'll find a lot of folks say, oh, you have to put the numbers and the special characters and all these things in there. And that's great. It looks complicated, and maybe another human can never remember that password. But it doesn't. Computers can crack those passwords pretty easily if they're short. Getting a password 12, 15, 20 characters long is actually your friend, because it takes a lot longer to try to crack it.
Hmm. And it doesn't necessarily have to be, as you just described, this jumble of glyphs and letters. It's just that it is long. Is that correct?
Just long. Use phrases.
Right.
You know, put the spaces in there. Put dashes in there, exclamation marks or other. You can put any of those things in there, but have it something that makes sense to you that you'll remember a sentence. Maybe it's a sentence of your favorite poem or the first sentence of a book you like, but something that's long.
So I usually do the last, like, what can you leave us with question? But Nancy, you pick the question.
I will go off topic. I will totally take this opportunity. And Jason, just briefly, obviously, knowing what you know about security systems potential for hacking, should we be voting? Should our elections be held using computer systems of whatever they are, state by state?
So I don't think there's a right answer here right now. I think we saw with the, was it 2000 election, with how the paper system works out sometimes. If we really are going to go to a completely digital system, and this is talking about in-person digital system, we need to make sure that we have auditors that are reviewing code, that can review code, that make sure that it's doing exactly what we want to do. If we ever move to an online voting system, we've got to do something to make sure that voter fraud doesn't happen. I mean, we're looking at just in general news, we're looking at things that can affect our elections, and that's not even allowing people to vote online. So I think we have a long way to go. We're going to have to secure that process and audit it significantly.
Thank you so much for being here. Jason Belford, yeah. Chief Information Security Officer at UVA, very knowledgeable, all things cybersecurity. Thank you.
Thank you.
So also, Nancy.
Yes. Are you looking for a palate cleanser,
yeah,
or you have something else to
no,
say? Because
yeah,
I will
ahead.
Totally shut up.
Yeah.
A palate cleanser? Okay, I got one.
Okay, what is it? Well,
okay.
First I want to do a little music.
Okay, there you go.
Okay. I couldn't find anything online. that was free and royalty free, so there you go.
You don't need to. My palate is so cleansed, is so ready for, anyway, okay, thank you for that. I do appreciate it. There is a school in Jackson, Mississippi that beginning next September will no longer be named for the president of the Confederacy and will be instead named for the first black president of the United States, which Mississippi is in the United States, so you would think. But anyway, it is presently called the Davis International Baccalaureate Elementary School. It was named decades ago for Jefferson Davis. The school is 98% black, but the move was proposed by parents and approved by the students and faculty and staff members. They had a vote, all very transparent. And apparently, it will become the Barack International Baccalaureate Elementary School starting next September.
Wow, the Barack?
I know. Oh, that's true.
Or the Obama?
I'm sorry.
Oh no,
I was kind of casually the Barack Obama.
They're on a first name basis.
Yeah, you know. Anyway,
well,
I'm sure they'll use both. It's only fair. Barack Obama. Yeah, they'll go the whole nine on that. Yeah.
I heard Apple. So, I heard. Oh, did you want to say something?
No, I just say, what do you got?
I heard Apple has a new store in the Big Apple. Is that true? Have you been?
To the what?
To the Apple, new Apple store.
I have not. Where is it? No,
I didn't double check this, but I heard that Apple has a new store in New York City. But okay, so moving on to my second one. Katy Perry got stuck in midair somewhere in concert.
Did not know that either.
And
midair in concert.
I just wish that we could just, you know, that we were just looking for things to talk about and that's the kind of thing that we would spend our time on.
Yes. I know, the Kendall Jenner factor.
Right.
We don't have it right now. We're in need of it.
Right. Yeah. So next week, again, we have Richard Bonney on the opioid crisis in America, Ryan Wright on the deep and dark web. I wanted to thank the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty for their support. Our theme music is N3540-19800 by Springtide. I was getting a little nervous as I was looking at licensing agreements, and I feel like I should mention that again. And remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. And thank you, both of our guests. Fascinating discussions with Manuela Achilles from the German Studies Department, or the Center for German Studies at the University of Virginia. Catch us online, 947wpvc.org. And Jason Belford, thanks for doing what you do at UVA and for all of us. And thanks, Nance.
Ellen, thanks for doing what you do over there with all the dials and the knobs.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.